Thank you so much for joining us today. Welcome. This is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse. And we're bringing you today the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we always have information for you on how you can increase your status in terms of health and wellness for yourself, yourselves, and your family. And we have lots of on-ground adventures where you can meet with us directly, myself and co-host Dr. Eugene Zamperone, by checking out the website at naturalnurse.com under schedule. We have lots of events. For instance, coming up soon, we have a Chinatown trip where we actually meet in Chinatown and learn about tongue and pulse diagnosis, Chinese herbal medicine. We do Qigong in the park, and it's like taking a little mini vacation. We also have real vacations, for instance, to live with shamanic bush doctors in jungle areas around the world. We completed one in Jamaica, and we have one coming up again. Once a year we go there, and those are credited courses. We also have a 5 CEU credit course in the fall, October 4th, it's coming up at Stony Brook University. And I'm a clinical instructor in the Department of Family Medicine there, and we're having the second annual evidence-based natural and integrative medicine symposium. And it's in the beautiful area of Southampton. It's at Stony Brook University's Southampton campus. And in addition, if people do want to come out there for the day to get 5 CEU credits, or just come as a, if you're not a practitioner, you could just come to listen and learn. Dr. Peter Diadamo will be the keynote speaker. He is the author of Eat Right for Your Type and many other excellent speakers. Again, check naturalnurse.com under schedule. And we also have available rooms for rent at the campus. Very, very reasonable way to come visit the beautiful Hamptons at that excellent time of year. So we have lots and lots of things going on, so just check it out and join us. Today we have as our guest the author of The Gift of Adversity, The Unexpected Benefits of Life's Difficulties, Setbacks, and Imperfections, and that is Dr. Norman Rosenthal. And Dr. Rosenthal is quite well known as the person who actually came up with the diagnosis of SAD, seasonal affective disorder. He is the New York Times bestselling author of Transcendence, Healing and Transformation Through Transcendental Meditation, and is a clinical professor of psychiatry at Georgetown Medical School. He conducted research at the National Institute of Mental Health as a research fellow, researcher, and senior researcher for more than 20 years, and was the first, as we said, to describe and diagnose seasonal affective disorder. Dr. Rosenthal is the author of more than 200 scholarly articles, as well as books for the general public, including Winter Blues and The Emotional Revolution. And today we will be really focusing on his latest book, which is called The Gift of Adversity. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Rosenthal.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Now, you have certainly a long list of both accomplishments and years in research and learning. Let me ask you, what made you become a physician in the first place?
You know, I was always fascinated in the workings of the human mind. And for the first time in this new book, The Gift of Adversity, the reader will understand some of the roots of my curiosity. And really, they stem from being intrigued by my own mind and the minds of the people around me, the family members. For example, I talk about an amazing incident where an uncle of mine went on what's called an amnestic fugue. What does that mean? It means somebody completely loses their memory. They go off wandering about, not knowing who they are, and in time they find their way back to somebody who can help them, like a policeman. In this case, it was he turned himself into a police station, and they were able to put the pieces together. He was a veteran of World War II when it was common to have such amnestic fugues. Nowadays, they're rare. But just to see a person's
memory. I would like to backtrack a little bit.
Yes.
Why do you suppose that they've become less common than they
were? That is such a wonderful question, and nobody knows. You know, when I looked in a textbook of psychiatry from the mid-50s, say maybe 50 years ago, they talked about how common it was for people to have amnestic fugues. They went off wandering after the war. They didn't know who they were. And nowadays, when I was trained in my residency, the director said, you'll be lucky if you even see one of these in your entire career. And in fact, I never have in my whole career. But there, as a 13-year-old child, I saw my uncle disappear from under everybody's eyes. We conducted a search out of my home. And sooner or later, he turned up, and his memory came back in pieces. Now it was 1955, now it was 1960, now it was 1961. As he got treated, the memory came back sequentially, and I thought, wow, you know, this human mind is pretty amazing. And it's that kind of experience that sort of forged my interest in understanding and studying the mind.
Wow, that's interesting. So we don't really know. What makes something that I would wonder about is potential toxic substances that perhaps aren't in the environment, sort of a reverse environmental toxicity at this point, because we do know in olden days that things like lead that were in drinking utensils did lead to various psychological issues.
You know, it's a possibility, but the one thing that people have focused on is head injury. And in fact, he had been injured during the war, and then he had suffered a subsequent head injury in civilian life. And you know, there's the old, I don't think that they're necessarily around anymore, but there used to be cartoons and funny movies where somebody gets bumped on their head, they forget who they are, and then they get bumped again, and then all of a sudden everything comes back to them. I don't know if those movies are ever shown anymore, but in my childhood they often used to be. And in fact, there was some basis to it, because this uncle of mine had head injuries. And so I think it may be specific trauma rather than a general toxin. And believe me, you've got a complete advocate here in terms of trying to avoid toxins such as lead and other things, which can be, of course, very dangerous.
Yes, that's true. So it's just one of those things, and many, many things, of course, that are considered scientific, we really don't have all the answers about at all. Now, what made you come up with this book title, The Gift of Adversity? Because right away, that's a paragraph. I mean, a paradox,
yes.
Not a paragraph.
It's paradoxical,
paradox.
It's true. Well, you know, I had wanted to write, starting off, you know, as we go through life, we learn lessons from the things that happen to us. And I had developed a set of stories, quite interesting, I thought, you know, that dealt with my life growing up in South Africa and then coming to the United States and becoming a psychiatrist with all that involves and a researcher. So I had been through many curious circumstances, not only of my own, but of the people I met along the way, and I thought they would make great stories and there would be good lessons to be learned. And when I lined them all up and read them through, what emerged really, which was a surprise to me, was that we learn the most when things go wrong. It has been said that you cannot become a master sailor on calm seas. So it turned out that adversity is our best teacher. And obviously, I am not advocating adversity. I think, you know, it's an awful thing. It can be really disabling, crippling, deadly. However, it's pretty much unavoidable. We all have it to some degree or another. So the purpose of the book is to try and focus on the silver lining around the cloud. What is it that we can, firstly, how can we best get by adversity? How can we process adversity? But secondly, how can we benefit from it? So these are the things that emerged unexpectedly to create the gift of adversity.
Now, can I ask you just something that I'm looking at this beautiful book. It's lovely. The Gift of Adversity, The Unexpected Benefits of Life's Difficulties, Setbacks, and Imperfections. Is there a reason we have little goldfish floating across the picture of this cover?
You know, it's kind of interesting because this was entirely the idea of my editor who has worked with me before. And the curious thing is that there's this one little goldfish that's swimming in the opposite direction from everybody else. He's just swimming in the wrong direction. And life is probably going to be harder for him and for all the other goldfish. You know, he's going the wrong way. So maybe he's going away from the food. Maybe he's going towards the predator. Nobody knows exactly. But so many people have said to me on looking at the cover, you know, I feel like that little fish. I feel like I'm the fish that's swimming in the wrong direction. And I think it's because each of us has a unique life. And each of us has a unique life story and a unique path. We all, in a sense, take what Robert Frost called the road less traveled, because it's our own unique course in life. And I think that, yes, adversity comes along, but that's also what makes us particular and special and individual and unique.
And, of course, as you said, now there's just groups of people that I believe that would be referred to as optimists and pessimists. I know I'm definitely on the optimist side because people sometimes get annoyed with me. They'll say, oh, you're such a Pollyanna, because no matter what happens, I go, yes, but this is an opportunity for, you know, whatever it might be. Or even if someone passes away, sometimes it's tragic, but sometimes, you know, people are quite elderly and not well, and I see it as you know, a gift for them moving on rather than actually suffering every day. So then there are other people, no matter what happens, it seems like it's a tragedy to them.
Well, I think you're right. I think there are constitutional optimists and pessimists, and it has been said with some truth that pessimists may more often be correct in their appraisals of situations, but optimists are more likely to succeed. So, you know, the old story about the man who comes out of his home one day, and he sees a big pile of horse manure outside, and he says, oh, God, there it goes again. Bad luck happens to me. And the other guy who's got the same thing starts digging, and the neighbor says, what are you digging for? He says, I just know there's a pony somewhere in there, you know? And I think that encapsulates these two opposite points of view. Probably there is no pony in there, but if there is one, it's the optimist that's going to find it.
And also maybe someone could come out and say, wow, I needed fertilizer.
There you are. There you are. That's exactly. I need. Oh, that's so great. Put it over here and I'll pay you such and such. And so that kind of can do, everything is going to be okay, up to a point. There comes a point where blind optimism that is not really sensitive to feedback can really be quite damaging, isn't it so? You know, spending too much money because you're sure that something is bound to turn up any moment is not a good policy.
Now, let's just go back 1 minute in your long history of being such a top researcher. What led you to the concept of SAD? Because that is such an interesting problem that people have, and we'll just let people know, that seasonal affective disorder. And really, it's a combination of physical factors and psychological factors. So it's wonderful that you gave that a name instead of people suffering needlessly without having self-knowledge about it actually being an issue.
Well, if ever there was a gift of adversity, that was it. Because when my wife and I arrived in New York City, we'd never lived so far north. And we turned out both to be highly sensitive to light. So we really struggled through three long, hard winters and didn't know what had hit us, you know, difficulty getting out of bed, low energy, mind moving slowly as molasses, all the typical symptoms of seasonal affective disorder. And then, of course, in the spring, everything cheered up, and we thought, what were we fussing about? And this happened 3 years, and then I came to the National Institute of Mental Health to do some research in moods, in cycles, in rhythms. And so if it hadn't been that I personally had been so afflicted and seen my wife being afflicted, and I had responded myself to bright light, I would not have had the conviction to pursue what at that time was regarded as the lunatic fringe, a very strange, out-of-the-box, unusual thing. Somebody thought, you know, why is he bothering about that? And on the other hand, it's turned out that it's extremely common. It's very important. Millions of people suffer from it and stand to benefit from those treatments. So if I hadn't suffered myself and had that conviction that there was something there, I doubt whether I would have invested all those years in researching the subject.
But it really is so wonderful, I think, because I actually have that myself. And what I do is just stay in sunny places as much as possible. That's the best thing that works, but not everybody has that capability. But just by using light boxes, people can get tremendous help.
Exactly.
Because my children, my son and his wife, they live in Seattle, and that's a place that I would say that's really, really occurs. It's a much, much longer winter, darker winter, and rainier winter than we even have on the East Coast.
And you often get it in the summer as well. You know, you get dark days in the summer, and so it's really a very good place to know about seasonal affective disorder. And in fact, I've visited there, you know, many times and talked about the subject. And the last time I was there, being introduced for a transcendental meditation, the audience was asked, who over here has heard of seasonal affective disorder? And every last person put their hand up.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely well promoted.
Well accepted, exactly.
Which really helps people to know that. And that leads to a question in terms of each person knowing their own brain. In other words, gaining self-knowledge, being able to step back and look at how do you react to adversity. And you have a whole chapter on that.
Yeah, you know, I think we may all look similar, but our brains are, you know, all very different. And you know, somebody may look like they've got all their act together, but they may have a big piece of cognitive functioning missing. You know, one person may have no sense of time. Another person may have no sense of quantitative and skills and be running into monetary problems all the time. In my case, I have no sense of direction. I also have a really bad visual memory for faces. And that, you know, I used to, you know, I would say to my wife, you know, when we go out and we meet people, please step forward and introduce yourself. Because I don't have that particular capacity. I can remember names very well, but I can't remember faces. So whatever it is that is your deficit, it's very valuable to understand that, and then you can work around it. I remember as a child memorizing all the street names between my house and my grandmother's house. And everybody thought, wow, he's so clever. He remembers all the street names. But it was actually a compensation for the fact that I didn't have a very good sense of direction. And this was my way of remembering the route.
Well, in modern times, that problem is not too bad because you can just turn on the GPS and completely compensate for it.
That's true, but it emerges every now and then where you go out of a building and now you have to think, now do I turn left or right to get to the coffee shop, you know, because the building's got like three entrances, you know, and depending on which entrance you've walked out, it's in a different direction. And that's when, once again, it's a very humbling experience. Take me into a complex shopping mall, turn me around three times, let me out of it. And I've learned, you know, this is where your parking is, make a note of the number, and so on and so forth. Because I remember one time with my family, it was in the snow, and I'd parked the car, and I had no idea where this car was. And so you do need to understand your brain. You need to understand your body. These are little bits of adversity that all of us need to get familiar with. So in the book, I start gently with small bits of adversity, little things that are our little struggles. They may be little in retrospect, but at the time when we're very small, these things loom large. For example, the inability to connect a bat with a ball or your foot with a ball means that you're not going to be the soccer hero. You're not going to be the cricket hero. You're going to be picked last for the team. Now, you know, from the vantage point of an adult, big deal. When you're a little child, that sort of thing can loom large, and it shapes the way you deal with the world. And these struggles are necessary, but triumphing over these struggles and learning from them can become gifts as well.
Well, what I love is your quote here in the chapter, Know Your Brain, and this is from Bruce Jenner, who, of course, is a very famous athlete, and said, if I wasn't dyslexic, I probably wouldn't have won the games. What mm-hmm. does he mean by that?
Well, because, you know, I can't put myself in his head, but what I take away from that statement is, you know, if I had been a good scholar and I would have focused on my studies and I would have, you know, ended up maybe being a doctor or a dentist or in school and being told that I had an uncle in South Africa and he was a brilliant swimmer, and his swimming distracted him from his architecture studies, and he was told at that time, either you give up your swimming or you're going to flunk out of school here. And his parents said, listen, it's very costly to send you to school, and we're not going to be willing to do it if you're going to be distracting yourself with your athletics. So sometimes people are forced to make choices between one thing and another. And what he may be saying is, you know, my studies were so bad that I put all my efforts and I invested all my ego and my focus and my concentration in becoming an athlete. And that has paid off tremendously. And so in a sense, the dyslexia was a gift to me.
Well, how would you say somebody could begin to step back and, you know, follow with what you're saying here in terms of know your brain?
Well, I think it's a really great question. I think, you know, ask yourself, what am I really good at? What are the kinds of things that I do so well without even trying? And what do I really, really struggle with? And everybody knows very simply what they do well and what they do badly. And then you can say, well, how can I get help just to be good enough at those areas that I'm actually not that good at, and get an adequate level of competency. You know, you don't need to be your own bookkeeper, but you should be able to understand how much money you've got and where it's going. So, you know, get adequate levels of competency in areas you're bad at, and then take areas that you're really good at and develop them to the max, you know?
Well, that is good advice. And we're just going to take a few mm-hmm. minutes right here, go for a little break. We're going to hear one of our natural medicine chefs. And listeners, when we come back, we are going to continue our discussion with Dr. Norman Rosenthal, MD, really someone who has been working with the brain and a top psychiatrist on many levels. And we'll be continuing to talk about the gift of adversity, the unexpected benefits of life's difficulties, setbacks, and imperfections. We'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll explore the medicinal properties of the plants of the ephedra genera, focusing on the traditional Chinese ephedra, also known as mahuang.
Many species of the plant ephedra are used today in medicine throughout the world. The most medicinal of these are Ephedra sinica, or Chinese mahuang, and Ephedra nevadensis, also known as Mormon tea. Most of the research on ephedra has been performed on mahuang, whose stems and branches have been used as a traditional Chinese medicine for over 5,000 years in the treatment of asthma, hay fever, bronchitis, as well as the common cold.
Ephedra species are erect evergreen shrubs which grow in segmented bamboo-like joints reminiscent of straw ending in thin wisps. They typically are desert plants preferring arid conditions on dry, rocky, and sandy slopes. The Chinese ephedra, mahuang, has earned an impressive reputation as a source of the alkaloid chemical called ephedrine. In the West, scientists became interested in the medicinal usage of mahuang after they isolated ephedrine and pseudoephedrine in 1923. Today, synthetic derivatives have become widely used in prescription and over-the-counter medications. In 1993, over 40 million prescriptions in the U.S. contained these alkaloids.
Ephedra and its relatives are considered to act pharmacologically as sympathomimetic compounds. This means that they stimulate the sympathetic part of our central nervous system, responsible for the release of adrenaline, which leads to the fight or flight response. Ephedra also affects the cardiovascular system by increasing the blood pressure and causes a relaxation and dilation of the bronchial smooth muscles in asthmatics. Ephedra can shrink the swelling of the delicate mucous membranes which line the respiratory system, thus drying up watery discharges, unstuffing clogged nasal and sinus passages, which accompany colds, sinus conditions, and allergies.
In both animal and human studies, mahuang has been shown to accelerate weight loss. It has been shown not only to suppress appetite, but to increase the metabolic activity of the adipose or fat tissue. Therefore, ephedra's weight-reducing effects are most significant in individuals who have a low metabolic rate or a sluggish thyroid gland.
Mahuang is a powerful herb which, when abused, can cause some unwanted side effects. Ephedra should not be taken by those with high blood pressure, nervousness or anxiety, insomnia, cardiac conditions, or pregnancy. Studies indicate that when used in conjunction with other Chinese herbs in a traditional formula, mahuang does not have any of these effects and has remarkable beneficial effects on human health.
We recommend consulting a healthcare practitioner knowledgeable in the use of botanical medicine before using mahuang, so you can be further educated about its totality of effects. And before using herbal preparations with mahuang, check to see if you are sensitive to its effects by starting with the minimal dose and working up to a therapeutic dose. Logically, since ephedra is a stimulant itself, it should be used prudently with other stimulants, beverages, or drugs with stimulant effects. Again, consult with your natural healthcare practitioner.
So, listeners, remember mahuang, the traditional Chinese ephedra, and make sure to include it in your natural medicine chest.
And we're back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. I do want to make a little bit of comment about our natural medicine chest in terms of ephedra and mahuang. That is an excellent reason to pay attention to what's going on in terms of regulatory affairs in the natural products industry, because it is becoming extremely difficult to talk about what herbal medicine might be for. In fact, the FDA is, as we speak, going after many nutraceutical companies. Now, one of the things they do is use ephedra or mahuang as an example of something that can be harmful, and the truth is it definitely can be when it's abused. On the other hand, it's an excellent medicine when used correctly, as it has been for thousands of years in traditional Chinese medicine. And even when we look at its safety record, I think it was linked to a few people actually dying when they used it, especially along with cocaine and other heavy-duty stimulant drugs. If we even just look at something like Tylenol, which is an over-the-counter pharmaceutical, that actually kills thousands of people every single year in that situation using ephedra, even though it does have some danger, pales. And yet the regulatory environment is so much more intense in terms of propagation towards natural therapy. So that's just something to pay attention to. We always love you to visit our website at naturalnurse.com. Click on schedule so you know when and where to join us. Or go to Facebook, The Natural Nurse. On Facebook, The Natural Nurse, we have many listeners letting us know what they think of our various radio shows, television shows, YouTube videos, all the things we have out there. Of course, Dr. Zamperone and I are the author of many, many books. You can find them at naturalnurse.com under books. And our wonderful guests. Now, today we have as our guest Dr. Norman Rosenthal, medical doctor, best-selling author of Transcendence, Healing and Transformation Through Transcendental Meditation. And he is a clinical professor of psychiatry at Georgetown Medical School. And he conducted research at the National Institute of Mental Health as a research fellow, researcher, and senior researcher for more than 20 years. He is also the first psychiatrist to describe and diagnose seasonal affective disorder, known as SAD. And today we are discussing his book, The Gift of Adversity, The Unexpected Benefits of Life's Difficulties, Setbacks, and Imperfections. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Rosenthal.
It's good to be here, really.
Now, as a psychiatrist, I do want to ask you, because it sounds like even with various therapies of SAD and also dealing with, you know, adverse situations, it seems like psychiatry has gotten very away from what we do in terms of, let's say, on-couch therapy or even behavioral modification, and are leaning more to just pharmaceutical interventions for all kinds of psychiatric issues, even mild depression. And what is your take on that?
I think that the practice of psychiatry has been heavily influenced by managed care. And in general, psychiatrists charge at higher rates than other therapists, in line with their much longer training, which is much more costly, and in line with what other doctors charge. So managed care organizations will be unlikely to reimburse at psychiatrist rates for therapy. They say these people are trained to give medicines, that's what we'll pay for, and let people with less expensive degrees, social work degrees, and incidentally, this is nothing against social workers or any other therapist, because sometimes a social worker could be a better therapist than a psychiatrist, could have much more experience or much more acumen. So I'm not in any way casting any comments about that.
It doesn't sound like you are. You're just explaining to us something very logical in terms of why this might be going on.
Right. So the upshot is that psychiatrists are seeing people for 15 or 20 minutes a shot, and it's like a revolving door, patient in, patient out, change the medicine, up the medicine, down the medicine, get this and this test. And I think for that reason, in a lot of settings, psychiatry has become quite an unrewarding practice. What I have always done sometimes I'll work collaboratively with therapists, but I love to combine therapy and medicine, because the mind is so wonderful and so vast, and there's no one solution. You often have to combine different approaches in order to achieve the maximum impact and best outcome. So I think it's true that in many instances there's the revolving door pharmaceutical approach, but I think that a therapy is going to come back in because it works, and people want to be heard and understood, and they want help in having their problems explained and organized and resolved. And I think psychiatry is a great profession. The only question is how it's going to be afforded. That's all.
Yeah, that is really interesting. That's not the take I would have thought at all, and I really appreciate that practical explanation because I can see through your history. I mean, you wrote a book on transcendental meditation, so that certainly is one way, not the only way, but one manner that people can learn to be much more self-reflective and look at, take a step back and look at how do they react to adversity.
Yes, indeed. I myself have been astonished at the power of transcendental meditation to help people overcome adversity. But you know, it makes sense. Because when you're confronted by adversity, it throws you into a spin cycle. You get overwhelmed, and it's hard to know where even to begin. Your mind becomes muddled. And your body becomes muddled, and there's a tremendous temptation to rush for quick fixes, whether it's alcohol or drugs or just denying something, spending, shopping, something, you know, when the going gets tough, the tough go shopping. We've all heard that. You know, anything that takes you away from the problem and just kind of gives you a quick fix. Well, of course, that's all going to make the situation worse. But one thing about this transcendental meditation is not only does it calm you and settle down your sympathetic nervous system, but it also promotes coherent thinking and creativity. In one of the chapters in The Gift of Adversity, it's called The Gift of Meditation, I look at people with the worst kinds of adversity, drug abuse, imprisonment, homelessness, some of whom have really miraculously extricated themselves from those awful circumstances, and credit transcendental meditation as one of the keys in getting them out. Not the only one, and as you pointed out and so wisely, it's never just one thing. It's always a cluster of different things, but in that cluster, TM was very important. So severe adversity can be impacted by this technique, but let's go to the other side of the spectrum for a moment. Subtle adversity. I had not written a book since 2002. That was about 9 years, because writing a book is really difficult. You've got to have focus. You've got to be able to sit with your solitude. You've got to really be very organized and able to get that time blocked out and do the work. And so I hadn't done so for 9 years until I started meditating again. And the meditation led to transcendence. It's led to the gift of adversity. I revised my classic Winter Blues. I'm coming up with a new book called The Winter Blues Handbook. All this creativity was made possible through my twice daily meditation, which settles me down, focuses me, organizes me. I can't say enough good things about it.
Well, I have been doing transcendental meditation since 1976.
Wow.
I've been doing all holistic medicine since 1964, so TM was actually much later on. But one thing that I've done with many patients over the years is, although you're saying you're sitting twice, and they do suggest a full 20 minutes. And that's something I've often found is an issue for people to make that kind of time commitment. But I have found even 5 minutes twice a day can be very, very useful and sometimes less overwhelming in terms of a time commitment.
You know, I, as I said, I'm a very flexible psychiatrist. If somebody said to me, I've only got 5 minutes twice a day, and I can't do any more, I'm not going to say to them, do 20 minutes or nothing. I think that would be just silly. But then what I might do is, if they started with 5 minutes a day and they came to me and they said, it's really great, this 5 minutes a day, I might say to them, you know, have you thought of pushing it a little bit longer? And I'll tell you why. Because, you know, often I thought, well, why 20 minutes? You know, it seems very arbitrary. But I don't know about you with your practice, but what I find is sometimes it takes me 5, 6, 7 minutes just to kind of settle in. And then all the good stuff really starts, you know? that we...
I would say that's true. I will share with you, Dr. Rosenthal, something. I read an article, and it was several years back, and believe it or not, of all things, it was in Newsweek magazine.
Uh-huh.
And what they did was a brain study looking at the part of the brain that goes into that zone that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They tested transcendental meditators, nuns, and perhaps also Buddhist monks.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to isolate the part of their brain, which actually is the part of the brain that recognizes the differentiation between self and non-self,
mm-hmm.
and found that that part of the brain turns off when anyone's using any one of these techniques
mm-hmm.
that works
mm-hmm.
for them. And
mm-hmm.
from the day, that day forward, what I did was I was able to identify that part in my brain just by looking at their
mm-hmm.
Thermography images and just snap it off in a moment's notice
mm-hmm.
without going
mm-hmm.
through too many rituals of any kind. So for
mm-hmm.
me, that has truly been a blessing.
Well, it is wonderful because a key to this state that we call the fourth state of consciousness, which, you know, I'm a very skeptical person. I'm a scientist. When people talk to me about the fourth state of consciousness, I said, you know, don't give me that hooey. You know there are only three states. But indeed, I went on to experience it. And it's a state where boundaries seem to evaporate. You know, the time, the date, where I am. It's not that if somebody shook you and asked you these facts, you wouldn't be able to reconstruct. It's just that they don't seem very important right then, you know. It doesn't really feel relevant. And then the other thing you said that's so great is that, you know, once you are meditating regularly, then you can almost at will go into that state even during a wakeful state, which is a wonderful phenomenon.
That's so true. Now, once people, you know, how would somebody evaluate what kind of reactor they are? Because like you said, sometimes, you know, again, looking at my own life, as you did so much in your book, The Gift of Adversity, when I think about, let's say, my mother and my mother-in-law, you know, just for an example. My mother, if there's dust on a piece of furniture, will actually get uncomfortably excited about it in a negative way. My mother-in-law, she actually got shot in a gunfight one time in the ghetto, and she just was laughing and saying the good things that happened because of it.
Hmm. Well, that's really somebody who can recognize the gift of adversity. Why she gets upset about a speck of dust, that's a fascinating question in its own right. I'm glad she was able to process.
Well, these are two different people, right? These are two different people.
Oh, these are two different people?
Yeah, so one person, you know, here it is, the top of the table is dusty, and I mean really screaming and upset and
mm-hmm.
gets shortness of breath, you know, over something that minute.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there's such a different range of reactions
right.
to what
right.
people could outwardly say are negative or adverse effects.
Right, but you know, the reason I kind of confuse the two is that I have seen people who can overreact to trivial things, and then when something really bad happens, they can rally.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's very funny. People are really strange, you know. They can really carry on about a very small thing. And yet, you know, when the time comes and the chips are really down, they just come to the fore. It's really strange. The brain, it's so wonderful. And as a boy growing up, watching all these curious people like the ones you're just telling me about, imagine getting that upset about a speck of dust. You know, what does that mean? It's so interesting, you know?
That's true. Well, we do need to take one more break at this time because we love to give Progressive Radio Network, which is our home network right here, Gary Knowles Network at PRN.FM, a chance to let our listeners know about all the excellent shows that we have right here on Progressive Radio Network. And when we come back, we will continue our fascinating discussion with Dr. Norman Rosenthal, medical doctor, the author of The Gift of Adversity, The Unexpected Benefits of Life's Difficulties, Setbacks, and Imperfections. We'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we're back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, inviting you to visit us and share your comments and requests at The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z or naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. So we're so happy that you're with us this morning or whenever you're tuning in, because people do go to the archives at Progressive Radio Network, sort of day and night, which is a good way to catch the show and all the great shows here on Progressive Radio Network. Today we have as our guest Dr. Norman Rosenthal, and we're discussing his book, The Gift of Adversity. Dr. Rosenthal, let's go back to a concept that you introduce about why it's essential to face your fears.
Yes. It's a really great question, because fear is a really crucial emotion, because it can basically save you from harm. The famous old example is the snake in the grass, that we're programmed to fear. Even almost before we know it's there, we jump out of the way. That's because in our biology we have evolved to just instinctively dart away. Those people who did not pass their genes along. So in any event, there are these fears that are really good fears, and in fact, people have written about the gift of fear, because it is a gift when it saves your life. However, there are also people whose fear system is exaggerated, like the lady you mentioned who feared a little speck of dust on a couch, or was very, very afraid. In my book, for example, I talk about fears that I had that turned out to be unjustified. I feared that a year in the South African military would be a terrible, terrible thing, and in fact, it gave me an opportunity to explore a beautiful land with my family, and it was one of the most exciting, enjoyable, adventurous years of my life. So my fear was unjustified. I quote from the book of Matthew, where he says that sufficient unto the day are the evils thereof. Do not borrow trouble. Do not let tomorrow's anxiety deal with itself. In other words, don't overdo the fear business. On the other hand, you know, we do need to be appropriately afraid. So talk about situations, my son's fear of water because he was mistreated by a bad swimming teacher, my wife's fear of driving, and how when these were confronted in a gentle and appropriate way, they overcame them and led a full life. So exaggerated fears need to be treated. Too little fear is a problem. It's just one of those things like Goldilocks' porridge. It's just got to be right.
So people have to take a step back and actually either work with a professional or in some other way figure out what it is they're afraid of, because sometimes it's not that obvious. Sometimes it's something more deep-seated.
Yes, often it will help. You know, for example, let's say a woman has been assaulted in a car. Now she's scared to drive anywhere. So, and very understandably so, but a professional can sit down and say, okay, is it okay to drive from your home to the supermarket? Has anybody ever been assaulted on that route during the daytime? And if she says, well, nobody has ever been assaulted, you say, well, that sounds like it's pretty safe. And how would it be if you were not able to do that? Well, it would be pretty limiting. I wouldn't be able to do the family shopping. It would be terrible. Okay, so now you're telling me it's a safe thing to do. It would be terrible if you couldn't do it. Let's work together to feel how you could become a little more comfortable. Maybe it means the therapist gets in the car with her and drives a couple times until she regains her confidence. But that's the kind of assessment you do. But if the woman wants to drive into the worst part of town and, pick up a hitchhiker on a, dusty road, well, that's not a good thing to do, and nobody should enable the person to do that, because it's bad judgment. So I think a lot of it depends on the assessment of the situation, and then once you've assessed it fully, you implement a game plan.
Now, what about the fact that making big choices often involves a commitment and a loss?
Yes, you know, I didn't really think this thing through until I wrote the book, but, you know, every choice is a loss. For example, I chose to leave New York. I was at the New York State Psychiatric Institute in Columbia, which I adored. I loved the city. I loved the school. To come to the NIMH here in Washington and pursue a research career, which at the time, this was a great training place. And so that's what I did. And I always kind of wished I had a parallel life. I could live in two places, but you can't. Well, some people can, but it's difficult. And so in choosing to move, I left something behind. And that's really the same many times over. In choosing one career, you might abandon another. In becoming a champion athlete, you might abandon being a doctor. Or in becoming an architect, you might have to give up being a champion swimmer. Oftentimes, life causes us to have to choose. And that wonderful poem, once again, by Robert Frost, which I quote in the book, says, you know, I thought I could come back, you know, the road that parted ways in a yellow wood. I thought, you know, I could come back again and try the other path. But I knew, as way leads on to way, that that was unlikely to happen. So a choice is a loss. And it's important just to recognize that, because later on when you come back and you say, oh, I wish I'd done this, I wish I'd done this, so wait a sec. You made a choice. You used all the information you had at the time to do what you thought was best. And that's just how life is. We can't have both paths. We can't walk both ways at the same time.
So also, though, what about if someone is forced into making a large life decision choice, is there a way to let go and feel like this is my path and I don't have to worry about, oh, what if I made the wrong choice? Because that often haunts people.
Well, it's interesting, you know, because, and here meditation is going to come back into the situation. I made a business choice to extend a lease that we had. And I was, you know, I didn't know whether I should do it at the time, but I did it. And then the economy imploded and the pharmaceutical company, which, you know, where I was working with the clinical trials, they imploded. And so it turned out not to be a good business decision. And I chastised myself for it and I gave myself a hard time for it. And then during one of my meditations, I went into this beautiful state, transcendent state, and I was able to say to myself, you know, you made the best decision you could with the information that you had. It's not fair to revisit the whole thing through the retrospectoscope with a 2020 hindsight. It's just not fair to do that. I think you need to let this go. And there and then, I forgave myself, and that was the end of the story. So I think, yes, sometimes we make the wrong choice and sometimes we can fix it, but sometimes we really can't. And we need to figure out a way to let go of that so that we can go on with our lives in a constructive manner.
And how do people figure out a way? I mean, there must be learning tools, and seeing a professional might be something that people should consider.
You know, there are learning tools, definitely. My hope is that my book is a learning tool.
I would say it is. That would be a good
story,
one.
Every little story carries what I think is an important lesson. And people can read a story which is enjoyable in its own right, can look at the lesson, and can say, how does this apply to my life? How does it apply to my adversity? How can I use it? So fundamentally, I'm a healer and a storyteller. So I told some stories. I hope they will heal. But there are simple things like the old serenity prayer. You know, give me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can. This is a sort of fundamental aspect of being psychologically healthy, not struggling, not sweating it out if there's actually nothing you can do about something.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today. Just a lot of wonderful and thoughtful information. I love your discussion as such a well-studied and prominent psychiatrist, and bringing in the concept of transcendental meditation is really, I think, something that can be changing on a huge level to an entire society, even if it's not TM, but some other form of constructive introspection is just so wonderful. And thank you so much for giving us all your books and for outlining the concept of SAD, seasonal affective disorder. That has helped thousands of people by being able to focus, have a name, and a plan of action for people who suffer so much in the darker months. And we have been talking today, listeners, with Dr. Norman Rosenthal, MD, the author of The Gift of Adversity, The Unexpected Benefits of Life's Difficulties, Setbacks, and Imperfections. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Well, thank you so much. And people who want my website, it's just my name, normanrosenthal.com. Come visit me. And I'm on Facebook and Twitter as Dr. Norman. Would love to hear more from your listeners. Thank you so much for having me as your guest.
And thank you. Listeners, bye-bye. Until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.